This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up in the second half of today's show, we get a behind-the-scenes look at an antiques roadshow taping with an appraiser. But we're going to start today with a new program that is designed to help families cover the cost of specialized health care, which can be a major concern in a state with a lot of rural areas. Joining me from our Grand Forks studio is the Communications Director for the North Dakota Association for the Disabled, Mike Brew. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Ashley.
And in studio with me in Fargo is Kim Zeeb. She is a client services representative. Kim, thank you for joining us today.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Before we get into the new program, let's establish, Mike, what does the North Dakota Association for the Disabled do?
Well, in a nutshell, we're a charitable nonprofit that helps people with disabilities, children and adults, and health challenges. We try to make their lives more mobile, more independent, and more healthy through our various assistance programs. Primarily, we're an organization of last resort. We try to make sure that other services out there are exhausted or at least unavailable before we provide help. That's allowed us to not only be of vital assistance to many people, but to grow as well.
I saw on the website that some of those various programs include, for example, just the loaning out or selling or giving healthcare equipment.
That's correct. Our healthcare equipment program we call HELP. It's a loan program. A very popular program, and it's one of the few programs that has no income guidelines, so to speak. It's really available to anyone who needs durable medical equipment for loans of up to 90 days free of charge.
Kim, is there such a thing as an average day for you, or are they wildly different?
I like the difference, yes. I get to talk to some amazing people with varying diagnoses, you know, different disabilities and chronic health conditions.
When we talk about disabilities, are we talking almost exclusively physical? Is there mental, behavioral factored in there
as both.
Well?
It's both. So we help people with, mental health issues, people with physical disabilities, you know, mobility issues, people that have they've had an accident and now they're paralyzed. There's a lot of different situations that people are going through.
The new program, so this started right this year, so it is just a couple of weeks old, and it is called ASAP. It stands for Autism Spectrum Assistance Program. Kim, how will ASAP work?
This program was really developed to help families. So there's no age limit. So it's children, youth, and adults. It was really developed to reach out and fill some gaps in services that are not available. And when we started talking with autism professionals, the people that are in direct contact with these families, we were finding out things that were very important and they were missing. And one of them was out-of-town medical travel help. Mm. People that are living in rural communities and they need to travel to places like Bismarck or Grand Forks or Fargo for services for their family member with autism. And, some are several times a week. And that's a lot of money when you're looking at, traveling with
hundreds of miles.
Exactly, exactly. So that really, really drew our interest, and then we also found out that there is help out there for respite care, but there's a maximum amount of hours, and sometimes families need more than that. Mm. So we also that's also a part of this program, is that if you qualify, we can help with a certain amount of respite hours per week.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mike, is that a typical approach for determining how you're finding gaps and ways to help, that it would be person to person, either talking with medical care providers or with the families?
It's not an unusual method at all, partially because, you know, we don't have the one-on-one contact with the clinical people, the individuals who are dealing with various disabilities, various health concerns. So we've got to go to the experts and find out what they're finding. And we were fortunate, too, and Kim was a lead in this research, that we had some additional information come out last year that really helped secure the idea that this was a need. Mm-hmm. And it was something that NDD was in a position to try to help.
Autism, of course, is on a spectrum, and there can be some very high-functioning people on the autism spectrum, and then there can be the flip side of it, where there is a great deal of care associated with that, specific to the ASAP program. Do you draw a distinction where a person is at on the spectrum? Kim, you want
okay.
to take this one?
No. No, it's a person that's diagnosed with autism. So it, okay. it covers the entire spectrum.
Okay.
Like Mike said, we're not the medical experts. And we just want this program to be available for anyone that needs it.
Do you have a sense of how many people you'll be serving with this?
You know, at this time, we don't. Mm-hmm. We know that there are quite a few people, you know, based on our research, there's quite a few people in the state with autism. But right now, it's really unknown. We just really hope that this program just grows.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really undetermined at this point.
So, Mike, how do you get or set aside funding for a program like this where you're not even really sure how many people and necessarily for how long?
Well, NDED, like other nonprofits, reviews its budgets on a regular basis. And in a nutshell, we determined that we have some room in the budget to at least begin to address this need with a fair amount of confidence because of the research that there are, once people find out it's available, that it will be used. It does cover people in all ages, but we suspect that one group that may be particularly interested or at least involved, maybe the people in that transitional phase outside of the school years, where a good deal of the available assistance now, it doesn't reach them.
You're the communications director. How do you get the word out about this program?
Well, we really just begun that, but we've had information out in our quarterly newsletter. We've been putting information in news releases to multiple media sources, including yourself. We have launched a social media campaign that will continue as we begin to see clients, as we begin to see examples. Mm-hmm. We'll use those examples to try to further extend the communications reach and let people know that they shouldn't necessarily include themselves out of this process, that it may well help them more than they believe.
Sometimes with programs like this, and for example, if you are getting housing assistance or if you are getting food assistance, the SNAP program, there can be income guidelines. Does NDAD require an income audit, I guess, is maybe the right word?
Well, Kim may address this a little bit more than me, but yes, we do have an application that you need to fill out in order to see whether you meet our existing NDAD guidelines. But that said, it's not a complicated process, and we're confident that a good many individuals with need will find it.
Kim, is there a program like this outside of people with autism?
NDAD does have a direct financial assistance program. So this is kind of an offshoot of that. So we do provide, to qualified clients, we do provide payment of prescriptions, durable medical equipment, the out-of-town medical travel for people. You know, there's quite a few people that are referred out of our areas, you know, over into Minnesota, like Mayo Clinic, that sure. Have to go for special surgeries. Mm-hmm. So we can, you know, help pay for gas cards and hotel with that, and home and vehicle accessibility, personal attendant care, you know, of that nature. So it's really just a sideline to that as well.
Would this program also similarly extend, for example, a specialist down in Mayo, or is this one more geared at specialists still within North Dakota?
Well, at this point, we're thinking within the state, but we don't really know yet. We know that North Dakota's really grown with autism services, and we really have come so far. You know, we're seeing more professionals that are here to evaluate people, to provide occupational therapy and behavioral health services, but not near those rural areas.
Mm.
And so we're pretty fortunate here in Fargo and Grand Forks, but maybe not for somebody that lives in a small community in the middle of the state. So.
Are you seeing more people being diagnosed with autism?
We don't work directly with, you know, the clients in that perspective, but over the past few years, as the applications have been coming in for help with services, I am in this area. I am in the Fargo area. I am seeing more people with autism.
We are visiting with Mike Brew. He is the communications director for the North Dakota Association for the Disabled, and also in studio, Kim Zeeb. She is a client services representative. We've been chatting about launching a new program aimed at helping cover the transportation costs of getting some specialized care. The program is called the Autism Spectrum Assistance Program, or ASAP. And Kim, what drew you to want to work for the North Dakota Association for the Disabled?
It is an amazing organization to work for. It is small in number of employees, but we make a big impact. I like the fact that we are statewide and that we don't have an age limit per mm-hmm. se. And it's what we really offer, the services that aren't available in other areas. It's just a wonderful organization to work for.
Mike, how many people work for NDAD?
Well, there are more than 100, but that's a little bit of a misnomer because it includes our charitable gaming okay. operation employees. But we have 4 offices for our client services: Fargo, Grand Forks, which is the base and has been since it was founded in, or at least organized in 1975, and plus offices in Minot and in Williston. So we definitely have a reach throughout the state, and plus we are serving people who live in border communities and surrounding states. So NDED has grown actually from an organization that had less than $100 to its name as a local support group in 1982 to one serving 2018 served almost 2,500 people through its programs.
I was on your website, and it's ndad.org. Mike, what is this partnership that you have with Target Circle?
Oh, Target Circle is a brand new program. We're one of 4 nonprofits involved or chosen through Target. It's a program that they'll be doing on an ongoing basis. It had trial runs in parts of the country. Now it's reached North Dakota as of, I believe it was January 6th. And from now through March 31st, people who shop at Target in person or online can register their purchases either on site or online, and they get votes. They get chances to vote for one of four nonprofits. We're one of them. And at the end of that time, they'll split their charitable contribution, whatever they plan, and divide it based on the votes among these four charities. So it's a program we've never been involved with before, and most of the country hasn't been involved with before. And and we welcome the opportunity to do so and encourage people to register at Target Circle online.
Are you seeing a change, Mike, in the way that generations, different generations, want to contribute to organizations like this? You know, in crisis, a lot of times people will just text on their phone to the Red Cross, for example, and then $5 gets added to their phone bill. Now you're seeing all these things like dip jars where you can just put in your credit card at, I don't know, well, Walgreens, and it's set up to benefit the YMCA, or like you mentioned, this Target Circle. What kinds of changes are you seeing?
Well, I think it can depend, Ashley, on a variety of factors, including, of course, the economy, and not just national economic factors, but regional or even local. We are an organization, in fact, that unlike many nonprofits, we do not do active fundraising for ourselves. We certainly take contributions. We are involved each year in Giving Hearts Day, which is coming up February 13th for so many great charities and nonprofits in our region. But beyond that, our fundraising primarily takes place for other people in one of our programs, our community fundraising program, where we help people and community groups raise money for needy individuals, and with some marketing assistance, with some assistance in dealing with the cash they raise, 100% of which goes back to these individuals. And in that sense, most of the fundraising we see are people who are in contact directly with the people in need. And we don't try to get in the way of that recognition. We just try to help enable them to make the most of whatever they contribute, young or old, to help these people.
Kim, we have about a minute left. Budget, no concern. What would you add to NDAD?
Oh, goodness, where do you start? I usually, you know, after listening to somebody tell their story to me about what they're going through, then something will pop into my head. You know, maybe I'll write it down and share that information. And that's what's great about our client services. You know, like Mike said, we're in four different offices. We communicate very well with each other, and we share what's going on in each of our communities. And there are similarities most of the time. And we sit down and we talk about those, and we think, what can we do for these folks? Could we expand? And we do. And we really, you know, our board is open to listening to our ideas. I find that amazing.
You'd just like to keep on growing.
Exactly.
It's ever evolving.
Yes, it is.
Kim Zeeb is a client services representative for the North Dakota Association for the Disabled. Kim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Mike Brew is the NDAD Communications Director. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. We really appreciate it.
You can find out more about the Autism Spectrum Assistance Program and everything that NDAD does at ndad.org. Coming up next on Main Street, commentary from Mark Trahant.
And on tonight's Valentine's dessert cart, a pot au creme, a creamy cinnamon-scented custard topped with a thin layer of caramel. We also have a chocolate hazelnut pavlova, which is a crisp hazelnut meringue dressed with hand-whipped cream and chocolate ganache. And I'm sorry, but what are you eating?
Well, I sort of brought my own dessert. bittersweet cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry. My sweetheart got me these during Prairie Public Short and Sweet Drive.
And such a fancy box.
I know! For a $10 a month sustaining membership, which helps pay for tons of excellent non-commercial programming and fact-based news, Prairie Public sent me this elegant one-pound box of delicious hand-rolled truffles with just a hint of port. Fits kind of neatly in my purse.
You know, we do accept truffles as tips.
Just go to prairiepublic.org to order your box or boxes of truffles today.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. The once-a-decade census kicks off this week in the village of Tuksuk Bay, Alaska. Enumerators will be doing what they can to make sure that every village resident is counted. In this commentary, Mark Trahant, editor of Indian Country Today, talks about the challenges and importance of counting residents in Indian Country.
In Tuksuk Bay, there will be Yupik translators working with the Census Bureau to make sure that the count goes smoothly. But across the country, that's a real problem. Natalie Landreth, a senior attorney for the Native American Rights Fund, told Indian Country Today that $0 are being spent on language assistance in Alaska. She said Native groups were told that if it was important, they should do it on their own. And that's not the only problem with the census. Indian Country is difficult to count for many reasons. Distrust of government, rural geography, and the lack of street addresses, transportation, even Wi-Fi. Across the country, demographers figured the last census reflected an undercount of 4.9% for Native Americans and an even higher 8% in Alaska. That literally translates into the loss of millions of dollars for roads, health care, and other essential governmental services. Landreth said it's important to remember that the census was not designed to count every American Indian and Alaskan Native, so it's an act of rebellion when it does occur. She says, make yourself heard because I don't think they want to hear from you. The reason why the census is in the U.S. Constitution is representation. Every 10 years, the data from the census are used to draw congressional districts and, in each state, legislative districts. This is an attempt to make sure that every person has a voice. And we have a long way to go in that category. Previous census reports figure that American Indians and Alaska Natives are about 2% of the population. But representation in Congress and most state legislatures is far less. There are a few states that use data to buck the trend, though. Montana has worked hard to make that happen. American Indians make up 6.7% of the state and 7.3% of the legislature. That's rare. Most states have little or no Native voice in its governing body, and Congress is only about 0.75%. My grandmother used to tell me about life during the Great Depression. She said my grandfather finally found a job with the Census Bureau, paid $1 a day. She told me, we found an old railroad boxcar and moved there. We lived on beans and potatoes for months and months, but at least we had our own home, and that was better than living with his mother. There are a lot of family stories in the census records. By law, the documents are sealed for some 70 years, but after that, there's a treasure to be found. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can read more from Mark Trahant at trahantreports.com. Still to come on Main Street, we go behind the scenes with Antiques Roadshow, and we have an essay from Chuck Lura. But now, it's time for the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. North Dakota is enjoying a period of warmer weather after last week's snow and cold. Temperatures over much of the state will be at or above freezing. That compares with highs last week that sometimes had trouble climbing to zero. So how long can this milder weather last?
We're expecting a break from the Arctic air at least through the middle of next week, possibly beyond that.
Michael Holland is forecaster with the National Weather Service in Bismarck.
We're looking at above normal temperatures favored even through the end of January.
Holland says February marks the last full month of the meteorological winter, and that means Arctic outbreaks are possible. However,
looks like we might get at least a week and a half to 2 weeks of highs, mostly in the 20s to 30s across North Dakota, and even warmer possibly in the Southwest.
And Holland says for now, there are no signs of any major winter storms that would impact our area. The State Industrial Commission has approved a loan program for farmers and ranchers impacted by the weather in the 2019 production year. State Agriculture Commissioner Doug Goring is one of three members that make up the Industrial Commission. He says the program is designed to give producers a chance to look at their operating shortfalls and develop a financial plan going forward. Goring says growers will need to talk with their bankers about the program, and the bank would then talk with the State Bank of North Dakota to develop what Goring calls a bridge loan.
Some banks have actually said, you know, we can do this already, but there's a lot of our community banks, a lot of our local lenders. That's really not an option. Concentration may be an issue for them. Maybe lending limits are an issue for them. This gives them the ability to tap a Bank of North Dakota program where we can provide a lot of assistance and a lot of support to our banks in our communities, but also to those that are going to be getting that money. That's going to be to those farmers and ranchers.
Goring says after seeing the amount of stress created by last year's weather, it makes sense to offer the program to producers. He says there are a lot of people that are looking at wrapping up last year's work while putting things in motion for the 2020 growing year. Otter Tail Power customers could see an increase on their electric bills soon. The company is proposing an increase in its renewable resource cost recovery.
The renewable resource adjustment covers costs associated with renewable generation.
North Dakota Public Service Commission Brian Crosius says the company is proposing that it go from its current credit on electric bills to a 3.7% increase.
The impact for a typical residential customer, if this is approved, using 1,000 kilowatt hours per month would be an increase of approximately $2.72 per month.
The PSC has opened an opportunity for hearing, meaning that if there are requests that the matter be subject to a formal commission hearing, the PSC could set up that hearing. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Many a bird lover might feel no such love for the squirrels at their bird feeders. In this week's Natural North Dakota, biologist Chuck Lura encourages us to share the love.
We have a red squirrel gobbling up sunflower seeds in our platform feeder for much of the winter so far. But it's been providing us with some great entertainment, so we just have to put a little extra sunflower seeds out to make sure the birds are fed as well. The red squirrel is generally regarded as a species of the northern coniferous forest. Here in North Dakota, however, it may be found in wooded areas associated with the Red River and its tributaries, Pimento Hills and Turtle Mountains, along the Mouse River and along the Knife River. Elsewhere in the state, the species distribution is uncertain or undocumented. Like the more widely distributed fox and gray squirrels, red squirrels are active during the warmer days of the winter. So we've seen a lot of this furry creature this winter. During cold spells, however, they generally stay holed up in their nesting cavity or perhaps a leaf nest. Where conifers are abundant, the bulk of their diet is conifer seeds. But in our area of largely aspen forest, the diet may consist of aspen buds and catkins, nuts and seeds of other deciduous trees such as oak, and of course sunflower seeds. Red squirrels are known to cache food for winter use. Several years ago, I made a nesting cavity from a hollow aspen log with about a 2-inch knot hole in it, hoping something would use it. I've observed several birds and mammals going in and out of it over the years, but no nesting to my knowledge. However, a couple years ago, it was full to the brim with acorns, assumedly the winter stash of a red squirrel. By spring, it was empty. Red squirrels are territorial. Whether we've been seeing a male, female, or both, their breeding season will commence around February and March, with 3 to 5 young born about a month later. I've assumed we've been seeing the same squirrels in our yard for the past few years, but that may not be the case. I've read that only around 25% survive their first year, and an 8-year-old squirrel would be a very old one. So perhaps we've observed several generations of squirrels in our yard. Many people that feed birds view the squirrels, red or otherwise, as thieves. But they deserve a little help from North Dakota winters, too. Plus, they can be quite entertaining. So give these high-octane fur balls a break this winter. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
They see the world a little differently in the Scottish Hebrides.
So we have a saying where I come from. You head up south and down north. Up south is meant to be closer to heaven.
get the story behind the Atlas Obscura.
It kind of broadens your appreciation for what even might be out there.
And enjoy the melancholy of Portuguese music.
You appreciate Fado more after your first broken heart.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. North Dakota is a main character in 3 episodes of this season of Antiques Roadshow. In June of 2019, the Roadshow crew filmed at Bonanzaville in West Fargo. The Bonanzaville episodes air January 27th, February 3rd, and February 10th at 7 o'clock Central. I also will be hosting a behind-the-scenes documentary that will be airing February 10th at 8 o'clock Central. And one of the featured speakers in that is folk art antiques appraiser Ken Farmer.
Ken, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
What is folk art?
That's a good question. People still discuss that. And for some people, they think it's something primitive that somebody with no skills made, when in actuality, the best folk art is an expression of someone's skill and emotion. You know, how many times do you ever look at a carving or a painting or any object that draws you in because of its appearance and it evokes emotion in you? And that's, to me, the best folk art is that. And it covers many, many categories. There's, you know, back in the 30s and 40s, they said that they thought it was, people that were unsophisticated, that were rural people versus, you know, urban people. And that sort of, that approach to it sort of goes all the way back to Europe and England. And it's only been in the last 5 years that they've actually had a major folk art show at a major museum in England. Wow. You know, because it was looked at as the art of the lower classes. But in America, there were some pioneer collectors in the early 20s, 30s that went out there and looked for stuff. Abby Aldrich Rockefeller was one of them, and she and her husband started this little place called Williamsburg. Colonial Williamsburg.
Perhaps you've heard of it.
But, you know, to me, it's a very subjective subject. And people ask me this all the time, and I say, well, I think folk art is defined by what the artist intended and how you want to interact with it, too. You know, and I've learned a lot from working with the other appraisers on the show because, you know, a couple of them especially are at the top of the feeding chain as far as folk art. And you know, they deal in, you know, 7-figure objects. Imagine that sitting in your living room. we haven't seen one yet doing roadshow, but I mean, you know, you go from there to something that's, you know, worth less than $50,
right.
and it's all folk art in its own way.
I might have some $7 objects in my living room.
If you like them, that's all that matters.
Do you remember what piqued your interest, and was it immediately in folk art, or did you kind of fall into this along the way, chasing your passions?
Wow, that's a great question. The short version of that is my mother always said that I had champagne taste on a beer budget.
Welcome to the club.
And when I was a kid, like 3 or 4 years old, she would take me to the dime store. I'm like, this is back in the 50s. And the dime store that was in the town that I grew up in, they had these gondolas, and the cap pistols and all the really good stuff was on the top of the gondolas so that the little kids wouldn't get them. And whenever she turned me loose in the toy department, that's the first place that I would head. And my wife and I, when we first got married, we didn't have any furniture, and we both had, she was a school teacher and I had a state job, so we certainly didn't have a lot of money. Within a couple of years, you know, I turned into an antiques dealer after that. But at the beginning, it started with us going to auctions, buying the stuff at the end of the auction that nobody else wanted, because we needed tables and chairs and, you know, things to put in our house. And as we went along, the other thing that happens when you do that is if you get too many things, then you have to start getting rid of it. And luckily, most of it was something that we could sell. And the minute that I realized that I could find this stuff and maybe fix it up a little bit and do something with it and make a profit on it, then I was gone. And, you know, I'd love to say that I saw this beautiful painting and it entranced me into this spell, and I was like, you know, overcome with the antiques mojo or something. But a lot of it was just things that we wanted to put in the house. And it was only after we started doing it that, you know, I started to learn the difference between something good and something great. And leaving something in the original surface, not refinishing things, that was a big deal for me. Because when I first started out, a lot of that stuff just looked nasty to me. And some of it still is. But, you know, if you had a great piece of furniture or a carving or something like that and it had the original surface on it, just think about it. If it's 150 or 175 years old and people's hands have been touching it all that time and it's been in the floor where they've been sweeping around it and mopping the floor, it's going to have some grunge. And that's the trade term. Little grunge, little crack lure, and that's an acquired taste too. But you know, basically, I think from the very beginning, I've just always really liked things that are fun to look at, that maybe things that have a sense of humor, but also have a presence.
Do you keep that kid in a candy store attitude at these antiques roadshow events?
Absolutely, it's. One of the other guys said it a long time ago. I read it in a newspaper interview, but he said, you know, every Saturday morning or every morning when we start roadshow, it's like Christmas. Mm-hmm. You don't know what's going to be under the tree. You don't know whether you've been bad or good.
Do you sometimes end up in an appraisal where you have the opposite reaction? Something just hurts, like, oh, this would have been worth a fortune, but you decided to put some glitter on it or something.
Sometimes I'll see something that's been refinished within an inch of its life, and it'll make me kind of sick. But then I have to put myself in the mindset of those families and what it was like. You know, a lot of that got done after the Depression, and even in the early 1900s, and you know, people didn't want stuff that was old looking, reminding them of when times weren't good, and they wanted something fresh and shiny. And if you stop and think about it, when the furniture and most of this stuff was made, it was shiny when it was new. So you kind of got to put it in perspective. But I judge every object on the basis of what it is, and I would never. I mean, you've heard, I remember one of the episodes a long time ago, some lady had a Windsor chair that they said was worth $5,000, and if it hadn't been refinished, it would have been worth $50,000. That's probably a message to get across, but I don't want to be the one to say it.
Well, you have to be kind of like a doctor with these bedside manners here, where
absolutely.
You're breaking news, maybe great news, maybe terrible news, but you have to practice like that doctor face, that poker player face.
Well, you know, it's hard to hide it when you see something you really like. Yeah. But even if you see it and you really like it, it doesn't mean that the owner doesn't know everything about it. Because one of the things that makes good TV is if there's some teachable moments in there. And you don't always have like a super aha price moment, but you would hope that you could add something to the equation when you do the appraisal that, you know, the owner's, you know, going to have a good reaction.
What's your approach for those teachable moments? Because those are really important to the Antiques Roadshow mission.
Well, first of all, the thing that's most important, other than the fact that, you know, is it an object that will, you know, be something decent to go on TV with. It's not about the money. Mm-hmm. I think it's about the story. And if the person that owns it is excited about it and somewhat animated, then my job is 10 times easier. Yeah. Because, you know, the one thing Marcia has taught us, the producer, and we have a little meeting every afternoon before the filming day, you know, and They always say, don't step on the guest, don't talk over top of them, and always find out how they got it, what they paid for it, or if they inherited it or whatever, and let them tell their story. Because if they have a cool story, then at that point I might have two or three things I want to say, like, how old is it, what's it made out of, what's the condition, or whatever the, you know, you only got about three main points, mm-hmm. and price being one of them. And you always do that at the end, although I've had some appraisals where the price was earlier, and some of the best things said were said after the price. You know, I had a lady in Phoenix bring some wood carvings in, and she became very emotional talking about when she and her husband bought them on her birthday in the 50s. And she told that story, and then she said her husband told her that he was going to last 60 years with her, but he was in an extended care facility because of memory problems. And it was very touching the way she said that. And when she said that, I said, that is exactly what this is about, that, you know, we have things in our homes and they bring back memories for us. They stir emotions. Those of us who do the roadshow, we're stuff nerds. You say you like interviewing nerds? Well, we're all pretty much nerds.
Well, I love what you were getting at there with the stories and the emotion, because it would be easy to describe this show as a show about things and objects, but you learn a lot about humans and what we are as people by what we value.
Absolutely. And it's not always about the money. It might be the fact that it was hanging in your grandmother's dining room, or maybe the stories that your mom told about it. And you have something, if you have something that came down through your family like that, you have something priceless. And no matter what we tell you, how much dollars it's worth, it's priceless to your family. Like, if it's been hanging beside the dining room table for 100 years, how many conversations have been said in front of it, and how many meals have been eaten in front of it? And, you know, those are the kind of things that really matter from a human point of view. We have a whole other side of this business that revolves around, you know, what's the best of the best, and, you know, what is a 7 or 8 or 9 figure object or whatever. That's entertaining too, but, you know, very few of us are actually going to be interacting in that capacity. So it's more, I think it's way more about the human stories and what people really treasure.
How much time do you get with people for the appraisals?
It depends on when they come in. If they come in first thing in the morning, we might film within 30 minutes. Like, when they open the doors, I think we have to be at our tables at 7:15, and I think the first wave comes at 8 or 8:30. And if you got something like the first thing you looked at, then you'd probably go pretty quick. At that point, you're going to talk to your table mates and see what they think. You might have a chance to do a little bit of internet stuff, but most people pretty much know what they're looking at when it comes to their table, otherwise they wouldn't be here. As the day goes on, you could have, you know, 2 or 3 hours to get ready.
How much interaction is there with other appraisers?
Oh, a lot. As a matter of fact, we have to get a second opinion and say who we got it from when we fill out the form, who our collaborator was on that. There's a lot of checks and balances, because we don't want to go on TV on Monday nights with millions of people watching you and be wrong.
It has happened, though.
Oh, sure. Yeah. What?
To you?
Not to me. Well, I'll tell you, I had a pair of watercolors one time that I thought were by this artist from Pennsylvania named Jacob Mantell, and I think I put like $60,000 or $80,000 on them. And they eventually went to auction in New York, and they took them out of the frames and figured out that they were done by this person in Pennsylvania in the 1890s. And they looked exactly like the artist. You'd have never known that if you didn't take them out of the frames. But there was a guy that was there at the preview at that New York house, and he had seen this person's work before. But we're talking about an artist that worked in the 1830s or 40s versus somebody that worked in the 1890s. Everybody else at the folk art table thought they were fine. And we had no reason to doubt them. They were the right size. They had nice frames. But, you know, the paper in 1890 was completely different from the paper from 1830. So once they got them out of the frames, they realized that that was this person. In the trade, you would say they were working second period. They were working, you know, a couple generations later.
How excited are you about Bonanzaville?
You know, Bonanzaville is a cool place. We went over there and looked around this morning, and I was excited. I thought it was cool to see the different businesses set up, like from the late 1800s. I didn't know that Fargo, North Dakota had a huge fire and got burned up in the late 19th century. And I think it was cool that they had the suffragettes. The history of a region like this is a lot different from where I am, because the first settlers in America were where we are in the 1600s and 1700s. And I guess this didn't get settled a lot until the railroad came through here and the government gave them all that land to pay for the railroad.
Have you been to North Dakota before?
Yes. I went to Bismarck. Mark Wahlberg was there, and I remember we did what we call a roll-in, where we went out to an outside location, and it was to some guy's barn, and he collected tractor seats, and it was so cool. All of that resonates with me because I grew up in a rural area, and when I first started my auction business, we used to have farm auctions where we would literally sell the land and everything that they had there, including the antiques. You know, we never sold cows or horses or anything like that, but that's the tradition that I grew up with, which is a rural area compared to a lot of the rest of the state where I'm from. The way things are out here, that very much resonates with me.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, you're welcome. I didn't mean to bend your ear so much.
That was antiques appraiser Ken Farmer, who will be featured in an upcoming Prairie Public documentary taking you behind the scenes of filming Antiques Roadshow. The documentary airs Monday, February 10th at 8 p.m. Central. The Bonanzaville episodes air on January 27th, February 3rd, and February 10th at 7 o'clock Central. Dakota Datebook is next.
The Greater Grand Forks Community Theater presents the state premiere of Lovesick, an absurdist little comedy by John Cariani, January 30th through February 15th at the Fire Hall Theater. Reserve tickets by calling 701-777-4090.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them. This is Dakota Datebook for January 22nd. On this date in 1909, the Golden Valley Chronicle alerted readers to a bill pending in Congress that would deny mineral rights to homesteaders. The Coal Lands Act was introduced by North Dakota Congressman Thomas Marshall. It would give homesteaders title to the surface land while denying them mineral rights. The bill was prompted by the coal famine that began with a strike by coal workers in 1902. People died over the winter from a lack of coal to heat their homes. Panic set in. Even after the strike was settled, people were afraid that the supply of coal would run out. In 1906, Teddy Roosevelt withdrew 64 million acres of land from the Homestead Act, thought to contain coal. Homesteaders who had worked the land in good faith could lose out. They would have to prove that their homestead was not valuable for coal to keep the land. Needless to say, homesteaders were outraged. Congress worked for the next 3 years to find a compromise. Marshall's bill passed and was signed into law. Homesteaders could keep their land, but the law contained, quote, a reservation to the United States of all coal in said lands and the right to prospect for, mine, and remove the same, unquote. The newspaper noted that thousands of homestead proofs in North Dakota were being held up until the issue was settled. This was disturbing for people who had followed the rules by living on the land and making improvements.
they were suddenly threatened with the loss of their land. They were not satisfied by compromise, since they would hold title only to the surface land. They would not be entitled to the mineral rights, which decreased the value of their homestead. While this is an interesting 1909 story, the Coal Lands Act also rippled down through the decades to a 1999 Supreme Court case. The Southern Ute Tribe filed suit against the Amoco Production Company over methane gas in coal on tribal land. The tribe said that their rights to the coal on the land included the gas. Amoco said the gas was separate and distinct from the coal, which had been ceded to the tribe. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of the tribe, determining that the understanding of coal in 1909 would not have included the gas. Therefore, the tribe retained the rights. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Prairie Public is a listener-supported statewide radio network. We cover everywhere in North Dakota, from the Bakken to Bismarck, Wishick to West Fargo. But we wouldn't be able to bring you NPR News, news from the Prairie region, and all the great cultural and music programs you enjoy without the help of listeners like you. And so, we would like to send a special thank you out to our sustaining members, whose generous monthly contributions keep Prairie Public's radio stations and online streams humming along, with quality programs and independent, fact-based journalism. Thank you, sustainers. We simply can't do this without you.
Americans are worried that foreign governments will interfere with the 2020 election.
The threat landscape has probably grown exponentially since 2016.
And false information on the internet has voters wondering who to trust.
Doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican. They all go behind the corner and try to get what they want.
What disinformation looks like in 2020 and how to avoid it on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Follow the Senate impeachment trial day by day with gavel-to-gavel coverage at prairiepublic.org and on Prairie Public's third multicast television channel.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, in the U.S., we pride ourselves on our democratic principles and practices. But some scholars say that democracy is threatened. And we visit with scholar Daniel Pemstein. He is an associate professor at NDSU and on the steering committee of the Varieties of Democracy Project, a large-scale data collection project that examines democracy and its growth and what threatens democracies across the world. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.